Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at Santa Fe Radio Cafe, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to introduce award-winning journalist Mark Danner. He writes for the New York Review of Books, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other publications. He's the author of 5 books, the most recent of which is Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War. He's the recipient of numerous awards, including a MacArthur Fellowship. He's a professor at the University of California at Berkeley and at Bard College. And he will be at the Lensic this evening, Wednesday, April 28th at 7 o'clock, in a Lannan Foundation reading and conversation with novelist Don DeLillo. And tomorrow, Thursday, at 5:30, he will be at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts, here in Santa Fe, giving a lecture titled Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, Torture, War. Welcome, Mark Danner, to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
So you were writing about torture throughout the Bush administration, and several very important questions are still important about U.S. practices. Most people have probably heard about what happened at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and other black sites. But one question, one of many questions that hasn't been addressed that much is, how do we compare to the rest of the world's brutal torturers? In other words, is the U.S., I think we have this kind of self-image of being less brutal in our practices than other countries known for their horrible torture methods?
Well, that's a difficult comparison to make. I think that if you look closely at the best information we have about what was done in the various black sites in 2002, 2003, 2004, much of what was done, particularly the combination of techniques, was extremely brutal. We're talking about fairly extensive beatings, use of sleep deprivation techniques that kept people away for 10 or 11 days at a stretch with no sleep, whatever. Use of cold, use of very loud music, use of dousing with cold water repeatedly to keep them awake in that way. Stress positions, keeping people chained, for example, with their hands chained to the ceiling and their feet chained to the floor, naked in very cold rooms for, again, 10 or 11 days at a time without letting them down at all. And this is even before you get to things like waterboarding, which was applied to one detainee 83 times in a very short period and to another 183 times. So the brutality of some of these techniques was pretty strong. You can go to some regimes that, boil people in oil and things like that still exists in the world. Some of the former Soviet republics, for example, in Central Asia. So you could probably, if you made an effort, you could find things that were even more brutal. But I think that some of the things that were done under the Bush administration were in really pretty bad, particularly when you look at them in combination, all of these things in combination.
One of the reasons I asked that was because I was struck by something that you wrote in one of your articles about people who had collars put around their necks, and the collars were tied to ropes, and these were used to bash their heads against the wall. And at a certain point, they put plywood up on the walls so that they wouldn't have detectable permanent injuries, but it would hurt just as much without actually killing them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is called the technique that was approved by the Justice Department, as all of these were, is known as walling. And the first time it was used, which was on Abu Zubaydah in the summer of 2002, a towel was wrapped around his neck, and the interrogator took the ends of the towel and smashed him against the wall, as you say, 10, 20 times at a time. And then he was placed in a close confinement box, a very small box, black inside, for a few hours. He wasn't sure how long. And when he came out, he was again smashed against the wall in the same way, except plywood, as you say, had been placed on the wall, clearly suggesting that the interrogators had become worried that they might break his arms or break bones, which is always the dilemma, you know, of the interrogator or torturer, which is how to inflict sufficient pain on someone without injuring them such that they won't be able to undergo continued interrogation. And it's a good example of the adjustments that were made to achieve that end. You know, how can we continue to wall this person without breaking his arms or doing something permanent that will mean he'll cannot be interrogated anymore? In fact, the towel eventually turned into a kind of leather collar, and later a kind of plastic collar, apparently, that seems to have been made specifically for this use, which had a couple of handles on it that the interrogator could grab and use to smash the person into the wall. So we saw this kind of evolution of techniques and evolution of equipment, if you look closely at the documents about what was done.
And we know all of this because of a report in which many different of these people who were tortured, who were all isolated from one another, told basically the same stories.
Yes. Well, we have a lot of information now about what happened in the black sites. What you're referring to, though, and what I write about in my book, In Stripping Bare the Body, is the report of the International Committee of the Red Cross, whose representatives, whose investigators, interviewed these high-value detainees in the fall of 2006 after they were moved from secret detention to Guantanamo. And they had not been in any contact with one another, either at the black sites or at Guantanamo. So these they told essentially their own stories without being able to compare them to those of others. And they matched pretty directly. And the stories that they told matched pretty directly with the information that the CIA gave to the Department of Justice on the program so that these things could be deemed to be legal. So we have a great deal of information about what was done, how it was done, and so on. And much of it, you know, I write about in my book.
The kind of torture that we're talking about, was this new under the Bush administration, or have we been practicing this in ongoing ways as part of our foreign policy for much longer?
It's a good question. I think there's a couple ways to answer it. One is, as an official matter, that is, these techniques, as approved by the Department of Justice and practiced by the CIA and officially approved by officials in the White House, that was new, no question about it. And I think that's an extremely important distinction to be kept in mind, that, in fact, under the Bush administration, these techniques, which, you know, the Red Cross, which has a statutory role in interviewing prisoners and deciding whether the Geneva Conventions have been violated, the Red Cross determined that this was indisputably torture. And under the Bush administration, these techniques were approved by the Department of Justice in an official process and ordered by the political leadership in the White House, including the highest officials of the country. That's unprecedented. I think there's nothing like that in American history. Have there been instances in the past where the U.S. Practiced torture unofficially? I think that's the answer to that is certainly yes. But never, to my knowledge, in a kind of official ongoing program like this, where the highest officials in the country not only approved it, but had lawyers write memos testifying that it did not constitute torture. And I think that distinction is very important because it essentially, you know, President Obama now, when he went to Oslo to accept the Nobel Peace Prize, one of the lines in his speech that drew the most applause was his saying rather fervently, you know, "That's why I prohibited torture," he said. And the hall burst into applause. And, of course, the president doesn't have the power to prohibit torture. Torture is illegal. It's illegal under international treaty, including the Convention Against Torture, under the War Crimes Act, under the Geneva Conventions, and under various American domestic statutes. So this is a significant change. I mean, the fact that he would say that really follows directly from the pretense of his predecessor, that he had the power to order torture. So we've now reached a point where torture, you know, which was at least officially an anathema, you know, something just you just could not do, has really metamorphosed into a policy choice. And that's true under this Democratic administration as it was under the previous Republican one.
Part of the reason I ask this was because I remember in the 1980s when there was such an outcry about the teaching of torture to Central American, what would you call them, soldiers at the School of the Americas. And the most horrifying tortures happened then under American training.
Yes, well, that's a complicated story. I mean, I wrote, my first book was about Central America, about the Salvadoran War, called the Massacre at El Masote, and I spent a fair amount of time reporting on this. And it is true that Latin American militaries, and this goes back quite before Central America, into the Dirty War in the Southern Cone, in Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, and so on, that American intelligence agencies were involved with their counterparts in those countries in teaching interrogation techniques and torture. And so was this different than what happened under the Bush administration? I would say it was, that we're talking about something rather different. Not something good, needless to say, but something different, in which the United States, as part of its effort to stop communist penetration in the hemisphere, was teaching security forces in these countries various techniques that they indeed did use. Did what happened in those countries rely, you know, would it have not happened if the U.S. didn't cooperate with them? I think that's very dubious. And when you see what happened in Argentina, for example, where 10,000 or more people were disappeared and torture of the most horrible kind was practiced, you know, it's a horrible thing the U.S. did this, but I don't think that the outcome would have been a lot different if the U.S. wasn't involved in these with these intelligence services.
We're talking to journalist Mark Danner. So former Vice President Dick Cheney alleges that our torture practices, which we've just been talking about, kept the United States safe from terrorism. Do we know if there was any truly useful intelligence that came from torture that helped protect Americans?
I think the answer to that would be no, we don't really know. The former vice president often makes claims that thousands of lives, or even he sometimes says hundreds of thousands of lives, were saved by the use of what he calls enhanced interrogation techniques. And he's been very vocal on this, beginning 10 days after he left office, which is really an unprecedented thing in American history. The former vice president gets up, you know, only days after leaving office and denounces the new administration. He makes repeated claims about what this, how vital this stuff was to protecting the country. When it has been the case that you could check what he says, it has tended not to be very convincing. At which point he will say, "Well, you know, I have proof. It's just it's still classified." Now, that's one of the reasons I think that we need a commission to delve into these matters, something like the 9/11 Commission, that would have the highest security clearances and could look at all of the documents that the vice president is presumably referring to. You know, there's a great deal of debate, particularly among people who were involved in these things, about whether they were useful. You have, for example, a lot of former interrogators with the FBI who claim that this stuff was a terrible waste, that it hurt the country, and that any information that was gained of importance, for example, from Abu Zubaydah, who was the fellow I referred to a few moments ago, was actually gained before these techniques were used, using more traditional techniques that the FBI uses that don't involve physical coercion. You know, did they get information using these things? I'm sure they did. I mean, they had these people in custody for years. It's impossible to imagine that they didn't get information out of them. The question really is, as President Obama has said on several occasions, It's not whether they got information. It's whether they got information that they couldn't have gotten using other traditional legal techniques. And, of course, it's hard to determine that with, you know, because it's based on a kind of counterfactual. I mean, what if they didn't do this? What would they have gotten? But I think that if we had a full investigation of this, I really believe that they would find that what they got, if they got anything that they couldn't have gotten in other ways, it was probably very little. But at the, at present, there's no way to say that for sure. We just simply don't have the information.
Do we have any information historically about whether torture tends to elicit useful information? And I mean, I wonder this because there are people who say that it induces false confessions because people become, you know, semi-crazed or even psychotic under those kinds of conditions.
Well, we know, you know, we can give a fair number of examples of that, even in, you know, in the present case. And the most famous is Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, who was captured by the Pakistanis, handed over to the Americans. The Americans handed him over to the Egyptians, and under American urging, so far as we know, he was tortured rather harshly, including waterboarded. And he, among other things, testified or said under that interrogation that the Iraqis had these mobile biological weapons labs, these laboratories that were hidden in tractor trailer trucks that were being sent around Iraq and that could, you know, at the drop of a hat, produce horrible biological weapons. He also said that the Iraqis had been training members of al-Qaeda in the use of chemical weapons. You may remember these claims because, of course, they were put before the world community, before Americans and the rest of the world, by the former Secretary of State, Colin Powell, on February 5th, 2003, in his famous speech to the United Nations Security Council. And that was an extremely important event that probably convinced an awful lot of people to support the war in Iraq. And that information, coming from the mouth of our Secretary of State, was false. It was just concocted, and it was false. So it is certainly true that these sorts of techniques do produce false information by people who were just, you know, desperate that they stop, that they be, you know, that the techniques stop. You know, an interrogator might say to this, well, lots of techniques produce false information. It's a key problem simply to separate the false information from the true information. And so it doesn't certainly settle the question, but it certainly is one major problem with using this stuff, that it produces false information. And we saw that, you know, the instance I've cited is an extremely important thing when you have your Secretary of State testifies before the world that the United States must invade a sovereign country and gives as evidence these so-called facts that were elicited through torture and that turn out to be completely false with dire consequences for the credibility of the country and the wisdom of its foreign policy. So that is an extremely important event, it seems to me, and it deserves to be better known by people.
Absolutely. Soldiers at all levels are trained to dehumanize the enemy. That's part of the training of being a soldier. And when reading these stories about torture, I can't help but think that, you know, this dehumanization turns into hatred and then a kind of sadism that takes on a life of its own, and it becomes punishment. It's this other thing than rational policy. And I was wondering what your views were on that.
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think particularly hard to answer. I think it certainly has influence not only on the behavior of soldiers and those dealing with prisoners. And those dealings could be very harsh in Iraq and Afghanistan, in part because there was a belief on the part of many soldiers in Iraq as well that, hey, these are the people who attacked us on 9/11, which, of course, was not true. But yes, it does result in that kind of attitude. And I think to understand the public's attitude about torture and about these techniques, one has to bring the sentiments that you've just cited into the equation. That, you know, many Americans simply look at these people and say, "The hell with them! They attacked us. They deserve whatever they get." And it's one of the reasons why you have the former vice president out talking about these issues, that there is a major segment of the American population, and on any given day, perhaps a majority, that is willing to say, you know, that there are occasions when the government has to use torture. And those numbers are quite substantial, particularly when you compare them to other countries, particularly Europe, but also in the Middle East. And I think you can understand that without thinking a little bit in the way you've just described, that, that people want to punish people and they want to take out aggression. And, and these are very human emotions, obviously, not very attractive ones, and also perhaps counterproductive ones, which is something to remember, that, you know, this may be comprehensible as in a way that humans react when they're threatened and when they're fearful, but it may be a very stupid, not to mention the illegal, way to react. Part of the job of the government, of course, is to respond intelligently, not to whip up counterproductive and stupid emotions from the public. But part of our political spectrum has been doing that consistently for a number of years.
We're talking to journalist Mark Danner. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. We're back with journalist Mark Danner, who will be speaking tonight at the Lenzik at 7 o'clock and tomorrow at the CCA at 5:30 in the evening. So our practice not only of torture, but also of, as you write about, rounding up masses of innocent young men who didn't do anything, like 70 to 90%, I think was the number, and imprisoning them without evidence, sometimes for extended period of time, that has significant political costs in our relationship with the rest of the world. What have been some of these costs?
Well, you know, I think the one has to get back to what is this war about? You know, what exactly is happening? What was Al-Qaeda trying to achieve in attacking the United States on September 11th? And what is the U.S. trying to achieve in fighting in these various places, Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere? And I think the short answer here is that they had a political project. They weren't just trying to kill Americans, although they achieved that. They were also trying to recruit people to their cause, to show the United States could be defeated, to produce a kind of iconic recruitment poster, which is the image of those burning towers, and to draw the U.S. into doing stupid things that would increase the allegiance of young Muslims to their movement. And that one of those stupid things was to get the U.S. to invade a Muslim country. They thought it would be Afghanistan. As it turned out, it was Iraq, which was much more useful to Al-Qaeda. And looked at in this way, the images from Abu Ghraib, the mass arrests that you talked about a moment ago, the images from Guantanamo, the reports about torture, all of these were extremely useful to Al-Qaeda, which was putting forward a view of the United States as this muscle-bound, brutal, aggressive superpower that humiliated Muslims and that took away their rights and repressed them and was partly the cause of their governments repressing them, etc. So looked at in this way, the torture, and particularly the images from Abu Ghraib, which have become so prevalent around the Middle East, were a major political helping hand offered to Al-Qaeda. And, you know, in that sense, they really were a very damaging self-inflicted wound that the U.S. did to itself. And I think some of the aftermath of that, some of the damage of that only now is starting to be repaired. You know, the level of dislike of the United States and mistrust of the United States in many of these countries went up to historically unprecedented levels, where in Jordan, for example, which is an ally of the U.S., only 8% of the population at one point were willing to say that they had a favorable view of the United States. And you may say, you know, well, we had to do what we had to do. What did you do? It's that those sentiments at one level enter into decisions that young Muslims make about whether or not they're going to support organizations like Al-Qaeda. So this war, such as it is a very complicated endeavor, most of which is dependent on political attitudes, not on who you shoot or who you bomb.
It's amazing. It's really as if we played right into their hands.
Yeah, I think that's true. To be fair, I think the Bush administration, one of their goals with Iraq, in the imaginary war that they thought they were starting, was, well, we're going to go in, we remove Saddam, we install a representative Shia government, and then we get out within 3 months, and you know everything is fine there. You have this thriving democracy. Now that was an imaginary scenario, and it never could have happened in the way they thought. But it was, you know, looked at in this way, part of an answer to what I've been describing. That is, that was supposed to be a political answer to the same forces of frustration and hatred of the U.S. That I've been mentioning. You know, well, we'll spread democracy. They'll be able to express themselves. There won't be the same kind of repression and frustration. And the support for these movements will eventually fritter away. That isn't the way things happened, as we know. But they were aware. I guess I'm just trying to make the point that the Bush administration were not unaware of this. They just tried to attack it in an extremely counterproductive way.
I suppose with the first Gulf War as their template, get in and out in 30 days.
Yes, that's right. Well, they had hoped, you know, the invasion was in the spring, of course, of 2003, and they expected to have all but 30,000 troops out by September. So that was the planning, you know, that they essentially the occupation would mostly be ended within 6 months or less. And that was a completely unrealistic, you know, scenario. I mean, it just was. You know, the lack of planning, of course, is legendary before the Iraq War. But they did, you know, if things had worked out and somehow miraculously in that way, the thinking would have been, well, you know, the war would have increased U.S. popularity rather than destroyed it. And, you know, that was the kind of fantasy that they had.
We're talking to journalist Mark Danner. I think one of the big principles that is important to discuss in the conversation about torture and the uses of torture is the whole question of the rule of law. And we saw with the torture memos and John Yoo and so on, the kind of twisting and bending of U.S. law to try to make things torture that were pretty clearly illegal. And it is kind of an odd situation that we find ourselves in now, you know, the first in the Bush administration and then under Obama, in which Republicans seem to be kind of against the rule of law if it gets in their way, and Democrats are in favor of it. And I don't know, it seems to me like if the roles were reversed and there was another issue in which Democrats were against the rule of law, they would never get away with it. And I'm wondering what's
well,
happening.
Well, it's an interesting way to think about it. I the Republicans, of course, would never accept those premises of what happened. In fact, all of the so-called torture memos to them were simply a way of showing that, in fact, this stuff was legal, and that it's not true that it was illegal, and one way or another, it wasn't really torture, and in fact, the Geneva Conventions didn't apply anyway, and, you know, there are a lot of rationalizations here. And you eventually get to the big one, which is the president can do what he wants during wartime. My colleague John Yoo here at Berkeley, one of the points he makes in his original torture memo is, you know, even if this is torture, no law can prevent the president from imposing it if he deems it necessary to protect the nation in time of war. And he really argues this, that in fact the president can do what he wants. He can exterminate a village. He can do, you know, nothing restrains him. And he has said this explicitly. Now, the Supreme Court said, no, that's not true, in fact. And it also said the Geneva Conventions apply. So many of these more extreme views have, in effect, been struck down by the courts. But it is interesting when you get, you know, the kind of reversals that you're pointing to in the ideology and histories of the two parties, that the Republicans, when you look at this notion of the unitary executive and the president having plenary powers during wartime and so on and so forth, that you really arrive at a view of a, quite a royalist view of presidential power during wartime. That, in fact, not only do his powers increase, which most people, by the way, agree that they do, but they essentially are unrestrained, according to this way of thinking. And, you know, one should emphasize that this is still, I think, a minority view of things, but its main proponents certainly are in the Republican Party. And during the first years of the War on Terror, they held sway in the Bush administration. And I agree with you that there's an irony in that, that the party for restrained government and the party that so loudly fears the power of government would actually be the party that supports absolute, unrestrained government that really is very like a kind of royalist attitude toward the chief executive.
There is a kind of conventional wisdom that Republicans are better at protecting the country, even while Democrats might be better at domestic policy, and it kind of seems to be associated with, you know, macho versus feminist gender roles, and you hear the adjectives hard and soft said a lot during these conversations. What's the truth of it? Are Republicans better than Democrats at protecting Americans?
Well, I would say the answer to that is no. But what you're pointing to really isn't a matter of historical truth one way or another. It's a matter of political fact, which is that, and both parties are very aware of this, that the American public as a whole still tends to give the Republicans slightly more credit in being able to successfully defend Americans and defend the country. That is, they give them a kind of national security bonus over the Democrats. And there are historical reasons for that, you know, that have to do with Vietnam, that have to do with, I think, the loss of the so-called national security wing of the Democratic Party when the Republican, when the South went from being wholly Democrat to wholly Republican, the white South anyway. You know, most of the military expertise in Congress and the Democratic Party was these long-serving Southern senators, mostly. So there are various reasons for it, but what's clear is that soon after 9/11, the Republicans recognized very clearly that a strong political advantage that they had throughout the late Cold War, which is the Americans' willingness to trust them on national security, and which they lost with the breakup of the Soviet Union, had been restored to them by the 9/11 attacks. And in fact, Karl Rove, in January 2002, so about 4 months after 9/11, said this publicly to the Republican National Committee, that the country trusts us national security. It trusts us more than the Democrats to protect them, and we can run on this, he said. So this was quite explicit, and by the time of the 2002 midterm elections, the Republicans were able, by running on 9/11 and running on national security and running on what we came to call the politics of fear, were able to score a very decisive victory in the midterm elections of a first-term president, which is almost unprecedented in American history. The Republicans won back the Senate in 2002. And so we had this strange transformation where the party that had held the White House during the most devastating attack on American soil in American history were able to claim that they could better protect the country and win an election on that, even as, you know, the smoking ruins of the World Trade Center still sat there in Lower Manhattan. And it's an amazing fact. And you see this further development of it with, you know, Rudy Giuliani last December, in January, and Dana Perino, the former White House spokeswoman for Bush. Both of them made similar remarks after the failure of the Christmas Day bomber on that plane over Detroit. Giuliani said, well, we had no domestic attacks under Bush, which is an astonishing statement, you know.
Right.
But in this kind of concoction, the Republicans, because they're stronger and because they fought the war on terror, they're able to protect the country. And Dana Perino said, well, we inherited that horrible attack. Inherited, she said. In other words, it was really the Democrats' fault. Republicans didn't let it happen, even though they were in office when it did. So, the political aspects of this in domestic politics are very important, I think.
Well, I mean, I think it's also worth mentioning that the attack didn't happen under the Clinton administration, and in fact that some very clear warnings were passed on by officials in the Clinton administration, and the Bush administration ignored them to their peril, and resulting perhaps, I mean, I don't know how far you want to go with this, but in 9/11.
Well, I think there's a pretty clear public record. The 9/11 Commission brought it out most obviously, and also books like Larry Wright's The Looming Tower, among others, that showed that there were an awful lot of pretty vivid signs that the attacks were coming, some of them quite specific, and that, you know, the most famous, of course, was the presidential daily brief that was delivered to Bush in Crawford, Texas on August 6th, so basically 5 weeks before the attacks, which was entitled Al-Qaeda Determined to Attack Within the United States. And there was a lot of much more specific intelligence as well, including, you know, the capture of Moussaoui in Minneapolis by the FBI, who couldn't get permission to look in his laptop, and which would have shown evidence of the attacks. The warnings from the FBI in Arizona that these people were training in flight schools and planning an attack. There was a lot of stuff, and one can't help suspecting that if you had a government that at its top levels was focused on this, as the Clinton administration had been through before the millennial attack, which was thwarted, that 9/11 could well have been prevented. I mean, there's no way to be sure about it, of course, one can never say what might have happened, but it is true that there were an awful lot of very explicit warning signs that the top levels of government basically ignored. I think that factored into the way the administration handled, you know, their vehemence after the attacks themselves, among other things. So I think that's very true.
Meaning the psychology was, oh my goodness, we screwed up, now we're going to be extra harsh?
I think there's a little bit of that. I'm not sure whether they actually admitted to themselves that they screwed up, but I think there was a knowledge that that there was a lot that was going to be uncovered about things that were missed. And, you know, there were people, holdovers from the Clinton administration, like Richard Clark is the most obvious one, who were desperate to have a full-scale National Security Council meeting on Al-Qaeda and could not get anyone to listen to them. And they finally scheduled a meeting the week before 9/11. You know, the same thing with George Tenet, who head of the CIA, who was pushing for various things. They couldn't get people to pay attention to them. And I think the political leadership in the wake of the attacks had to be very aware of this. I mean, of course they were. You know, when you get into kind of psycho-political explanations, you get onto somewhat shaky ground. But I think this is something real that one needs to take account of when talking about how they reacted.
There's one thing that we haven't really addressed yet, and that is how the various news media in the U.S. have handled questions of torture that we've been discussing today. What is your assessment when you look at, I mean, you write for the New York Review of Books, which has very long and detailed articles that are extremely informative. Most people do not read that publication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's a very good question. I mean, this story, you know, has now been in the press really for, well, 8 years. I mean, the first very prominent report about it was on the front page of the Washington Post in December 2002, followed a few months later by a big front-page piece in the New York Times. I wrote a book on the subject, which was called Torture and Truth, that was published in October 2004. So that's nearly 6 years ago. So this is a story that we have lived with. The press, I think one can't, one has to break it down. The print press, particularly the so-called mainstream elite newspapers, I think in, as a group have done a fairly creditable job. Washington Post, certainly the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal on occasion, particularly in the wake of Abu Ghraib in the spring of 2004, there was an awful lot of reporting on this, and an awful lot of documents were made public showing us the really basic story of what happened, of how these decisions were made. And indeed, the book I mentioned, The Torture and Truth, has a lot of those documents in it about how the, how torture came to be practiced. So since the summer and fall of 2004, we've known the basic outlines of the story. The problem is, I think, that when you talk about, you know, the American public and what information it has, what you said about the New York Review is true of the publications I've just named. Most Americans don't read them. And so you get to the question of where most Americans get their news, which is television. And this story has only intermittently attracted the attention of television, notably in the aftermath of Abu Ghraib, where the story, just for a brief period, became televisual. You know, suddenly that you had these images that could be broadcast, and television did take up the story for a couple of months. But pretty soon thereafter, it kind of dipped beneath the surface again and kind of, you know, went back into the gray newsprint. And in general, television hasn't been terribly interested in this story. There have been moments, for example, the spring of 2009, after the Red Cross report that I published and the subsequent release of some of these so-called torture memos by the Obama administration, it became a matter of political dispute, which meant it got on to MSNBC and CNN, Fox News. So again, it went on television for a relatively brief time. And that really has been the history, that when some documents come up and it becomes a kind of political fight, it makes it briefly onto the televised stage. But it's mostly been a story that's been in the print press. And the print press has done, I think, a pretty decent job. It's just, you know, when we talk about the media coverage of this, you immediately really get into issues that, you know, okay, well, it's been revealed. And at what point does it go from being a story that is about, gee, you know, if only people knew about this, we would, the policy would change, to a story that's really about, well, people do know about this. And so, you know, what does that say about what we think as a political, you know, a political world here? And it seems to me that the American public is willing, essentially, to put up with this stuff when it comes taking them as a whole. So at the end of the day, it isn't a matter, I think, of the press and its coverage. It's a matter of what we as political beings and as a polity, as a collective, are willing to countenance. And we seem willing to countenance this.
Yeah, it is. It's something I was thinking about it in connection with the health insurance debate that was going on in the U.S. And there's a significant number, I hope, minority of people who seem to lack empathy. In other words, you know, there was this hostility toward providing universal health insurance for human beings, for their fellow citizens. Mm-hmm. How do you understand that part of the American psyche?
Well, I think lack empathy is one way to put it. You know, many of these people would say, well, you know, I work hard, and why should I be paying to insure people who don't work hard? I mean, that's how they would look at it. I'm not saying that's, obviously, not saying that that's right. I'm just saying that they would look at it differently. And when it comes to social programs in general, that's a very common way to think about things. You know, I work hard and take care of my family, and they should do the same. And why should part of what I earn by working hard be given, you know, to someone else? That happens also to be wrong when it comes to health care, of course, because right. People end up paying for other people anyway. That's why the system's so expensive. And when it comes to, when we sort of patch that on to the question about torture, I think there is part of that, certainly lack of empathy is real, although one has to add in to that the fact that, you know, we're talking about others, which is to say not just American others, but others as in this, you know, Muslims, people who are on the other side of the world threatening to do us harm. So there's a much more, there's much larger distancing effect. It isn't Americans who are being tortured. I think that's one thing. And I think the other aspect that needs to be taken account of is that people are fearful, you know, and 9/11 was an extremely traumatic event, not least because it was so surprising, because 90% of Americans had no idea who these people were or what they were doing. And so this came completely out of the blue, even though they had attacked American targets very prominently before. It came completely out of the blue, and it also attacked directly civilians, that the people who were killed, 400 of whom, by the way, weren't Americans at all, it should be remembered, but the people who were killed were people who were just, you know, in their offices or getting the restaurant ready or, you know, on the phone working. And I think that made it, you know, that increased the shock of it and the fearfulness of it. And when you're fearful, you know, you're willing to say, we'll do whatever you need to do to keep us safe, you know, particularly if it involves distant people who speak a different language and whose culture seems different from ours. And so, you know, I think people, I don't know that it's simply a lack of empathy. I think it has more to do with just thinking, you know, if they're going to threaten us, we're going to do whatever we can to protect ourselves. And that last part, of course, is given, you know, probably the uselessness of these techniques and the counterproductive political effects they have, which you and I discussed, it's probably ignorant and counterproductive as well, unfortunately.
Well, and also the grouping of hundreds of millions of people into the word they, you know, when they attack us.
Yeah, well, you know, that's I agree completely with you on that, but that is a very deeply human emotion that is encouraged during all sorts of national hostilities. You know, when you have a war, grouping the other side into a they that has nefarious qualities and that isn't really human is just is a part of the way most nations deal with conflict, and most governments encourage their citizens to feel. And I certainly agree, there are more than a billion Muslims in the world. The numbers that are sympathetic to al-Qaeda are very small, and certainly the numbers who are actually involved in these sorts of activities are minuscule, you know, they're tiny. So to look at the whole, you know, Muslim world this way is obviously completely wrong. And, you know, the Bush administration, to its credit, you know, did try to make these distinctions. It made an effort to do so. But a lot of its policies encouraged the opposite view, I think.
So we've got just a moment left. You will be at the Lenzic tonight, Wednesday, in a conversation, a Landon reading conversation with novelist Don DeLillo. And then tomorrow, Thursday, at 5:30, you'll be at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe giving a lecture. What will you be talking about?
I'll be talking about the subjects that you and I have discussed, about torture, and also more broadly about the war on terror and war itself, the United States and the wars that it's waging. The book is called Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War. And the talk has the same title, although it's Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, Torture, War. So I'll be talking about our present wars and how they came about and what they're being fought about and how they might in sometime in the future, one hopes, end.
Mark Danner, thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and I so look forward to being in Santa Fe. So,
excellent.
Thank you.
We'll see you here. We've been talking to award-winning journalist Mark Danner. He will be at the Lenzic tonight here in Santa Fe at 7 in the evening, and then tomorrow, Thursday at 5:30 at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc and Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz.